same knowledge or the same intent as those other checks. So we're sort of drawing a line of demarcation between those checks, and I think that's significant. They were in a different jurisdiction, and they were drawn on a different account, and so forth, so it's separate. And as far as the standard of review, I think it would be clearly erroneous. The court has to be an abuse of discretion.
Thank you, sir.
Well, counsel, didn't your client, didn't he testify to that he in fact had pled guilty to those other check cases?
He did testify after the playing of the videotape that, of course, we objected to, that he did plead guilty to those other cases. Mm-hmm. But those other cases, again, we believe were a different, they were a different set of checks, different set of circumstances. The check that is in question in Campbell County that's before the court today was a check where, at least according to my client, and I know that the evidence is viewed in the light most favorable to the Commonwealth, but his point of view was that he had actually taken that check to the bank and inquired as to the validity of the check. And on cross-examination, the bank teller had testified, well, she said she couldn't remember if he asked that. But it is indeed possible, she said, that he did ask, is this check good? And so again, we would say, and also the purpose of that check, according to him, was payment for work that he had done for this man that he referred to as AT.
What about the time frame of the cashing of the checks? Is that significant, and how does that impact your argument about intent? Because if I understand the facts correctly, there's about a 90-minute time period in which all of these checks were cashed. So how does that not go to the intent element in terms of the other crimes evidence?
Well, again, I certainly concede the time frame is correct. But I guess we are pointing, again, to the difference in the checks. In other words, they had a set of checks, the AT person, I will call it.
But they're both business checks from two different businesses. I know they're multiple checks, but the accounts are business accounts.
They are business accounts, that's true. But as you stated, from two different businesses. And my client, according to his testimony, had worked for AT and was expecting payment for work that he had done for him, this lawn cutting work that he had done for him. And this check was payment for the work that he had done. Those other checks were a whole, you know, another line of checks and were being utilized for a different purpose. So even though the time frame is the same, it may have all occurred within a relatively narrow point of time, they were two different sets of checks and two different purposes. And that actually raises the point that I believe is important. It would be extremely difficult. Let's assume for right now that what he is saying is in fact true. It would be extremely difficult for a jury to set aside these checks were done for this purpose and this check was actually a legitimate check, because they are sort of muddled together. And I think that that's the exact reason that they should not be introduced, because of their clear prejudicial impact.
How do you deal with the fact that your client went to five different banks on July 16th with a total of six different checks met out to him from two businesses? Doesn't that sort of suggest that, couldn't a fact finder conclude that your client was aware that the circumstances that he was creating were culpable?
I think it would be right and fair to conclude that all of the checks that were in that group that were done in that, or talked about in the interview in Bedford and so forth, that they were together. I don't think that it would be fair to say that this check came from a different source, even though it was, in fact, inquired about on the same date or in the same time. I don't think it would be fair to say that that check or those other checks indicate that that check was also part of that scheme.
Well, let's look at this from a hypothetical standpoint. Suppose, for sake of argument, I've got 10 checks that I have gotten through whatever means. And five of the checks were from Judge Malvo's account. Five of the checks were from Judge Chafin's account. And I went to try to cash the ones from Judge Malvo's account, and those were not good. And I went to try to cash one from Judge Chafin's account, and somehow I was able to cash those. Wouldn't the fact that I had tried to pass Judge Malvo's checks around the same time that I tried to pass Judge Chafin's checks be significant or credible or circumstantial evidence that I knew that what I was doing was bad behavior?
If the circumstances were the same between those checks, I understand that you're saying that they're two different accounts.
Mm-hmm.
If the circumstances were the same, I think that the one distinguishing thing, at least, in the Campbell County check, is that there is at least evidence from my client that is not refuted by the teller that he did not try to actually pass the check, but he tried to inquire as to the validity of the check. Is this check good?
Well, the teller actually informed your client that the bank would not cash the checks because they were suspicious in nature, and then your client walked out.
Yes, but his testimony is that when he entered the bank and approached the teller at all, that before the teller said that his question, his query was, I'm paraphrasing, but I want to know, is this check good? Is this check good? In response to that, she checked the check and told him that it was not. And at that point, he walked out.
Yes.
And also, along that line of questioning, he didn't run, he didn't do anything to indicate any knowledge of guilt.
He didn't do anything furtive, he just walked out.
Just walked out. I think the cases also make mention of there being, the cases use terminology such as links, or that there is sort of like a progression of things that occur. And you can look at the Campbell County check completely in isolation apart from those other checks. You could completely separate them. And there is nothing that was done with those other checks that supports or helps the scheme, as it were, of the Campbell County checks. They could be segregated and separated that way. I think that is significant. The other aspect of the 1829 case, Lee, that sort of initially created this doctrine that prior bad acts or other bad acts are generally inadmissible, talked about the fact that in that case, the defendant had been charged with stealing a watch, and they presented evidence that he had stolen a coat, and that, of course, that was not credible evidence or acceptable evidence. I think that that's essentially the same thing here. I think that the Commonwealth is saying that, he stole a watch, and therefore he's also guilty of stealing the coat. He did that with this set of checks, and therefore he had to have done the same thing with this check. And because they're from different accounts, they are under different circumstances, I would submit, where he went in the bank and inquired about the check. This check was supposedly for payment for work he had done. It had a purpose behind it, and I believe that's why he was asking, is the check actually good? That this check is indeed different, it's separate, it's a different situation. But again, putting those other checks in front of the jury makes it virtually impossible for a jury to look at that case on its merits alone and say, did this man actually forge and utter this particular check? And that, I believe, is the danger and the prejudicial impact that this had on my client.
Thank you, counsel.
Good morning. May it please the court, I'm Victoria Johnson, and I represent the Commonwealth. We urge the court to affirm the trial court's exercise of its discretion in admitting this evidence. Not only is the
Ms. Johnson, just make sure we're clear, you would agree that other crimes, other acts, evidence typically is not admissible in cases, typically.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And I cited two concepts from your brief as to why you think that this is exception to the general rule applies. And your opponent colleague seems to suggest that while there may be some relation, he goes back to the old idea that the probative value still must outweigh the prejudicial effect. saying that just because there's some circumstances involving one set of checks doesn't support a prosecution for another set of checks. Why is he wrong in stating that?
Well, I think for a few reasons, Your Honor. And while the court did note that we were arguing about the guilty knowledge and the safer accident exceptions, we were also arguing that this evidence is relevant to prove elements of these offenses, which is another exception for which other crimes evidence can come in at trial. First, going to the probative value and the prejudicial effect, that is a weighing function that is within the trial court's discretion as well. So here, the trial court recognized that this was pretty prejudicial evidence, but also found that it was highly probative, largely because of the similarities between the crimes and that temporal connection that the court noted earlier. This all happened within about 90 minutes. This was, you know, and by the defendant's own testimony, his own statement on videotape, he talked about how he was given these checks, he was given a cut for everyone that he, you know, that everyone that he cashed, which tends to go to the idea that this was a one situation, one act. And there were a total of six checks. Some of them were drawn, the majority of them were drawn on the Integrated Technologies business. This one was the Keller Williams Realty business. But those businesses were located close together in the same office park. So we have a connection between the businesses, we have that temporal connection the same day, and we have the statement and testimony from the defendant that this was actually part of one transaction. He was going around taking these checks in, and the question becomes, well, did he lack knowledge, and how reasonable that lack of knowledge was to the jury. So I submit that that this evidence, while prejudicial, was highly probative, and that the trial court correctly balanced those two.
Counsel, I think his ultimate point, though, is that the underlying offense could have been proven without the other checks, and therefore, essentially, what would be your statement as to how prejudicial the other crimes evidence would be?
Well, in Bin v. Commonwealth,
rather inartfully put, but
no, I understand. Thank you. Well, in Bin v. Commonwealth, and I apologize, I don't quite have a citation at the tip of my fingers, but it's a Virginia Supreme Court case that lasted about 5 years. But the court held in that case that the Commonwealth doesn't have to elect its proof, because the Commonwealth, who has the burden of proof, doesn't know what proof the jury is going to be persuaded by. So while we can say, well, these two things would have proven the case, the Commonwealth isn't limited to just bringing that evidence. The Commonwealth can bring its full evidence to bear, and, you know, subject, of course, to the rules of evidence, which is what happened here. There was a motion in limine made by the trial court to make sure this evidence could come in and was admissible. That was fully argued before the trial court, and the trial court did that weighing. Did that address your
yes.
question? So I think that looking at everything together, the trial court did not abuse its discretion. Another way of looking at this, though, is that even if the trial court did make a mistake and did abuse its discretion, that abuse of discretion would have been harmless because of the evidence in this case. We have the bank teller, and I understand that on cross-examination, the defendant asked her if he had just asked if the check was good, and she couldn't remember. But her testimony on direct, on page 138 of the joint appendix, was that the defendant, and she identified the defendant and retained a copy of his driver's license, presented that check to be cashed. That was her testimony at trial. So that's pretty direct. And then it kind of became a credibility question between the teller and the defendant's theory of the case as to whom they would believe. I mean, that was the only kind of elements of issue were the intent and the knowledge for the forging and uttering. And, you know, I think that the jury could have heard the defendant's testimony, heard this kind of unlikely story about Mr. Thomas and AT, and rejected that and found that the defendant intended exactly what he did. He attempted to cash that forged check. And the jury was instructed on, I believe, accessory liability and Hairston's equal culpability under those theories. And I would submit that given all of the circumstances in this case, particularly the geographic closeness of those two businesses and the close, narrow time frame where all of these checks were passed or attempted to be passed, I submit that the trial court did not abuse its discretion. Furthermore, as noted by the court, I believe in the first argument, the defendant did kind of volunteer during his testimony that he had pled guilty to these charges out in Bedford County. He said, well, when those checks bounced, I just pled guilty to that. And the trial court ruled that kind of opened the door for the prosecutor to cross-examine him about those issues. And so I submit that the evidence would also come in that way because of the defendant who was testifying against counsel's advice kind of blurted that and put that at issue during his testimony as well. If the court has questions, I'm happy to answer them. Otherwise, I'd submit and ask that y'all affirm the conviction. Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel, it seems to me, and again, I hesitate to second-guess trial counsel because trials are very fluid and you try to do the best you can under the circumstances, but was there an instruction given to the jury as to how it was to consider this evidence?
There was not an instruction given to the jury.
And without an instruction, does it undermine your argument to some degree? Because you know, I'm sensitive to what you say, that you know, just because a person's committed one bad act doesn't mean that they're guilty of another bad act. That's a dangerous precedent to establish. And so I think it's important for a fact finder, particularly a jury who's unsophisticated in these kinds of things, to know that this is supposed to be given limited consideration in the deliberation. Does that put us in a box here?
I do not think it puts us in a box. In reading some of the cases, oftentimes, the court on its own motion will actually give such an instruction when it feels it's advised to do so. I don't think that puts us in a box today. I do agree that it makes it more difficult for the jury to make that distinction without an instruction.
In reference to the argument about not having instruction, that's not something that's been preserved and before us, is it?
No, I did not raise that as an issue. Regarding my esteemed counsel's opponent's statement that there was one transaction or that my client testified to that, I don't believe that in the Bedford interview that he testified specifically regarding the Campbell County check and included that in those checks. He was being questioned about the checks in Bedford County, is my recollection of the record. And I think it's also one sort of has to ask, why was this check a separate check? Why they had these five other checks, why this one check sort of standing alone? I think that also indicates that it is a distinct and separate matter. There also is a language, even in for example, Kirkpatrick, that says, regarding the facts, that they are so intimately connected and blended with the main facts adduced in evidence that they cannot be departed from with propriety. And I think that sort of sets a standard. The question then being, could you excise those other checks from this check with propriety and still be able to make the case? And I believe that could be done. And I believe that introducing it just simply served to muddy the water for the jurors, making it virtually impossible for them to not just say, based on this other behavior, he had to have also done this.
Thank you, Mr. Stewart. We'll come down and greet counsel.
All rise.